I think that you've all read Miniskirts, Mothers and Muslims, which has a subtitle, Modelling Spiritual Values in Muslim Culture. And it's by Christine Maloui. Christine is married, an Australian married to an Arab, and I first met them both in Egypt, but I have also met them in Morocco, and they do travel in and other Arab countries. So she's really talking about modelling Christian spiritual values in Muslim culture, which I think we are trying to learn how to model Christian values in Muslim culture. So it isn't just Arab, but her experience is mainly Arab. So I'm going to... You have kindly each taken a chapter, and so we'll work through the chapters of the book, and each one by one you will share a bit about how what you read and how you reacted to it. And if necessary, we will discuss and then go on to the next one. If there's not much to discuss, then I will just ask the next person. So Ruth is going to take the first chapter, which is about modelling spiritual values in public. And the subheadings for this relate to prestige and appearances. You know the book by its cover. It's a proverb, I think. Nakedness exposed. I don't know what that means, but it will be revealed. Thank you.
So she talks about in this chapter three important aspects of the Muslim culture. First of all, appearance and hospitality and family ties are the big things that she has mentioned in this chapter. It's a practical expression of the Ummah, or the community of Islam. And it's their view, how they view right and wrong. So as we go into a culture and consider maybe what we think of appearance, hospitality, and family ties, it probably isn't the exact same thing as they view it. So it's important for us to understand exactly how they perceive these things. In order for Muslims to perceive us as people of faith and principle, we need to express spiritual values in ways that they can recognize. Again, looking at how they perceive what's happening around them, how they perceive what we do. And if we don't follow these principles, then we, as missionaries, are considered indecent, we're considered shocking, and even to the point of being naked, which is they talk about later on. But this implies to us that we need to be recognized as people that are decent and respectable and religious. So in terms of how we dress, in terms of how we act, in terms of the things that we say, these will all be important factors as how they perceive us. In the Islamic society, it's a basically status-focused society, and she gives four different aspects of this status focus issue. One, status is based on one's social background, what kind of a background they come from in the family. Secondly, family is more important than accomplishments. Here in the States, we emphasize a lot on, or in the West, we emphasize a lot on our goals, what we accomplish, professions, careers, but they really emphasize the family. Thirdly, people prefer to associate only with their equals, so they would not be associating with someone at a lower class. It's a more of a class society, and so they would not be doing things with anyone outside of their equals. And then fourthly, the amount of respect one receives is permanently fixed and attention focused on those with higher status in spite of any personal failings that they might have. So in other words, once you see a person or once they see us, their respect for us will be permanently fixed. And so it's extremely important that we come across as a very a person that is decent and respectable. In spite of personal failings later on, that's not going to make a big deal because it's the initial attention and focus that they have when they first meet us. then she talks about how this applies to us as people going in. How can we influence all classes? And we can't expect to influence all classes. We'll be going into a certain area, and basically what she said is whatever class we live among, either high or low, we should choose a level within it that will give us a position of respect. Then the people will deem us worthy enough to have our words esteemed. She talks about name dropping. Basically, if we can get to know some of the more respectable people in that class, then we'll be respected more. And so to her, it's not bad to throw in a few names of some people, leaders that are respected in that area or in that city. When a culture is class rigid, we'll find ourselves locked into a class where we choose to live, work, and what kind of friends we have. So we need to live in an appropriate way and adapt to their culture with the visual presentation important. And she talks about 1 Corinthians 9, 19 through 23, as far as not being a Jew. Paul talks about being whoever to whoever needs to be. I can't remember how that verse goes. I was going to bring the scripture with me. and also she talks, too, as far as, appearance. And we most of us know that you don't have your shoulders exposed. Many times even your whole arm has to be covered, depending on where you're at. Your ankles need to be covered. And she brought out some things about gold. Many of us think that wearing a lot of gold is not, well, first of all, most of us can't afford it. But to them, it's an extremely important thing that shows that you are respectable, that you are a person of class. And so even if we don't have a lot of money, we need to invest in something that looks good for them in some of the cultures. I think of where I was at in Africa, and it wouldn't really relate to that specifically because most of them didn't have much of anything to wear, let alone gold. But the Muslims, and it depends on where you're at and what kind of people you're going to be working with. But we have to really be sensitive to the people that is the women that we're working with. So the Muslims recognize outward appearance as a way of making a statement of faith. We need to bolster our image by showing we are wise, mature, and meaning that we respect elders, that we follow the things that hospitality, those things that are there specifically stated in the Quran. And how we dress is an important thing. One thing she mentions, too, is one of our primary goals in living for Christ among Muslims should be ministering to their fear of Western moral corruption of their families. In other words, they're afraid that because of our influence, our Western influence, that the families are going to get ruined because there's been so much of the pollution of the West. All the worst stuff goes over there, and then they fear that as far as breaking down their family. So we need to be exemplary in our life and how we relate to our husbands, if you're married, how we relate to men, and how we relate to people and in all the things that we do. One thing she did mention as far as interpretation of modesty is we here in the States tend to look at the upper part of our bodies as the stimulation that would cause offense, whereas for them it's the buttocks. And so we need to be very careful as women how we wear our dresses and how we walk. And so this is just some of the areas that she mentioned specifically, but with a lot of focus in that area. So,
thank you very much, Ruth. That's very helpful. I'd like to emphasize one or two things that came out of this. This whole idea of how you are perceived. You won't be perceived the way you expect to be perceived. You've got to try and envisage or find out how the people around you, the Muslims around you, how you are perceived. And one thing I like to emphasize is be who you are. And I particularly apply it in the area of prayer. I have Muslim friends who wondered, when do you Christians pray? We don't see you praying. And I remember a family, a Christian family, who went to live in a Muslim street, a street occupied altogether by Muslims in a town in Pakistan. And they chose to live among Muslims, and they kept open house. They had some small children, and children came in and out of their home, and they got to know their neighbours. If they got someone called when they were due to have family prayers, they waited till later, till everyone had gone. So nobody knew when they prayed. Be who you are. We are people of prayer, so then we may have to take steps to be seen to be whom we are. This is not hypocritical. This is not disobeying where it says, go and close yourself off in your closet and pray quietly or secretly or whatever. No, it's being seen to be who you are. So they decided to have prayers after the evening meal, whoever came. And whoever came, they invited them to join them, or they gave them some opportunity to sit quietly and wait, or to come back again. So everybody in the street, of course, then knew that at a certain time, after the meal, just after the meal, the whole family would pray. Now, I can think of a principal of a college in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan, actually Edwards College in Peshawar, a former principal. He used to say his own morning prayers, personal prayers, very early, perhaps 6 a.m. And when the weather was good, and in the winter it'd be rather cold, but generally the weather was fine for sitting out at 6 a.m. He didn't sit out in the middle of his garden, which you could in the campus, so that people might see him praying, but he did it. I think he liked it, but he was being seen, perceived as a person of prayer, and he was being what he was, or he's dead now, but his students respected him greatly because they saw him reading his holy book and praying every morning at 6 o'clock, always about that time, always in that place. And so they knew that here's a Christian who does pray. So we might think about that, being seen to be whom we are, and it can apply in other areas. I think it's good if we openly give thanks before meals, pray. Muslims may see us doing that. And sometimes we may need to change the way we pray. It's better to say grace if you're out in a restaurant, perhaps with your hands up. Then otherwise they may think you're just looking in your soup. And I can think of a very good example when I prayed and I was having a meal by myself in a restaurant, because I was about to catch a plane the next day. So I prayed over my meal, and then one of the waiters came later. He asked me, are you connected with the Bible Correspondence School? Now, I don't know why he thought that, but I think he recognized I wasn't Muslim, but he recognized that I was a woman of prayer, and maybe I would know. He wanted to get in touch. So I said, well, I'm actually on the board of it. I found out what he wanted. But I suppose if I had been thoroughly British, I would have looked in my soup, and so it would seem, and said my quiet prayer. Well, I said a quiet prayer, but it was obvious I was praying. So now we'll move on to chapter 2. Ruth's taken a nice long chunk of, she had a long chapter. We're coming to the chapter on modelling spiritual values in behaviour. So, chapter 2. Thank you, Jay.
Well, in this chapter, Christine focuses on gender segregation and modest dress for women. She starts off by writing, "We must be careful in adapting patterns of behavior that are culturally sensitive." And she says that we must not assume that certain behavior or dress is acceptable just because we are told so, or even because we see it taking place. And the reason for that is as she states it, is that Western individuals are naive. They're naive in their understanding of the dynamics that are taking place, particularly in the Arab Muslim world, between men and women. In our world, she says that we relate to people asexually, whereas in the East and other cultures, the tension between men and women are very much of a sexual gender nature in their culture. And we Americans come in a very innocent situation, and we create a bunch of faux pas out of innocence on our part, but yet very offensive when it comes to relating to other people. She mentions that sexual segregation, particularly in the Arab-Muslim context, is not a sign of prudishness on their part, but again, it's the evidence for them of the power and the importance of sexuality. And of course, when you get back to the Islamic view of the nature of humans, both men and women, humans are created weak before God, and so for them it's an automatic issue that there's going to be temptation and potential compromise. And as I reflect on that particular statement, what comes to my mind is the various passages throughout, particularly throughout the New Testament, where God calls us as individuals to individual purity, and that going beyond the externals of separating between men and women and getting into the heart of how we really think and treat about each other. And that's why we have that biblical command that we are to treat younger women as our sisters, younger men as our brothers, older women as our mothers, and older men as fathers. And when we come at that perspective, then it takes on a whole new dimension of interpersonal relationships. But it's obvious that missionaries going to countries such as the Middle East are pretty much in a fishbowl. People are watching. And how you respond culturally in that context is very, very important. It's obvious that there are two standards that Muslims have for Westerners. They don't necessarily believe that we are going to be acting like them, and they don't expect us to on one hand, but yet on the other hand, we can compromise our relationships with the neighbors that we're trying to build relationships with because of the stereotypes that Westerners portray, particularly across the media. Then she mentions in her chapter that national Christians do not always set a good example, and we as Westerners cannot assume that they know how to live appropriately among Muslims. And she's referring primarily to the Dhimmi, the Christians that have lived in a Muslim country for many, many years. The separation between Christians and Muslims are so great that following the national Christian example does not automatically mean that you're going to have a sensitive approach to how to live among your Muslim neighbors there. And so she brings up some pretty good examples of warning Westerners to be very discernful when it comes to following the practices of any national evangelical or Coptic believer as a way of living culturally sensitive, you know, within a Muslim community. And then she deals with the effects of the emancipation of women, the growing freedoms that Muslim women are finding throughout the Middle East. And these women are faced with a tension coming out of a strong Islamic tradition with the growing rise of liberty. And as one Algerian student said, women have gained a certain amount of liberty, but we have not known what to do with it. And so, you know, women are facing the issues as to how do I live Islamic in a culture that has given me more freedom to come out of the home, into the marketplace, into the workforce. And so, you know, as we as believers trying to teach God's word, I think we need to be very sensitive to this particular dynamics that's happening in Muslim society and not necessarily exploit it in a wrong way, but we need to be sensitive in counseling when we are in a Bible study or discipleship relationship. we need to be sensitive as to what their responsibility should be as they go about in the marketplace as far as their relationships with men and how they dress. She mentions that Tunisia, for example, is interesting today because religious women are returning to Islamic veiling in spite of the strong opposition from the government, which is afraid of the fundamentalist movement. And Egyptian and Jordanian women did not leave the workforce but adopted veiling in order to participate in society outside the home. They want self-determination, but they also want it with respect and dignity. And so again, you know, the Muslim women, they want their freedom, they want to have more respect, but they still want to find it within the context of Islamic tradition too. And so that's something that we need to be very sensitive about. Overall, I think that when it comes with how do we as believers in Jesus Christ deal with the whole issue of the extreme segregation of men and women, I think we need to be very careful. Naturally, even though in Romans, when it talks about not giving an occasion for someone to stumble, that principle is primarily talking about eatings of certain food. But I do believe that that principle applies even when it comes to our behaviors and dress in other societies. And so we need to be very careful about those aspects.
Thank you very much, Jay. I'd like to make one or two comments. You can get into very difficult situations sometimes perhaps get a bit compromised. The worst example I can think of in my own experience is that most of the foreigners where I was living in the Punjab had at that time gone off to a convention, a Christian convention, and only two foreigners were in the town. I was one, and I had a next-door neighbour, and because of something that arose, he wanted to come and see me. So he told his watchman, looking after the guarding the place and looking after it, "I'm just going to see Miss Stacy, and I'll be back at 4 a.m. He was learning the language. Now, I think fortunately, the watchman realized he's learning the language and that he was going to be back at 4 p.m. I hope that was the case. And then certainly local Christians, I'd like to emphasize, are not always culturally sensitive. They are to their subculture, but they're not always to Muslims. I've had the experience of living in the Christian community in the Punjab, where Christians are, they're a minority, but they are in considerable numbers, thousands, and probably over a million Christian, a million and a half or nearly 2 million in the Christian community of the Punjab. If you go to the frontier, it's another story. But I found that the 60 families, Christian families, in the frontier town where I lived were much more culturally adapted than the those in the Punjab. They didn't like in the Punjab to say Assalamu alaikum, but in the frontier Christians did say it, and they didn't feel there was anything wrong with saying it, and I can't see anything wrong with it. It means peace be upon you, and it's peace of God, of Allah be on you, and we've talked about Allah anyway, haven't we, that there's no, it's a very correct way of talking about God for a Christian or a Muslim. I found that if I was giving some series of classes on Muslim-Christian relationship, I could cut down my syllabus by at least a third because the people in the frontier, in my very great minority, had become much more sensitive to relating. And they were more relaxed as well. Strange to be, maybe that's a bit strange that they should be so relaxed, but they didn't hedge themselves in, and they related very well, I thought. And then on the question of the emancipation of women, freedom with dignity, I think this is something that we have to explore. And it's quite unnatural for us in a way, as Westerners, It would be very inappropriate in this frontier town where I lived to do too much laughing. In fact, we did have a Canadian who came, a nurse, and she was always laughing. This is very un-Muslim for a woman to be seen. She could laugh at home with us, but shouldn't be going around the place laughing too much or laughing at all, and not generally looking directly into the eyes of a Muslim when speaking to him or her. Her is all right, but as a nurse she had to speak. Doesn't mean to say she couldn't look at somebody sometime, but we have a custom of very much eye-to-eye contact in the West, and so we have to watch on things like that. Well, it's very helpful to have heard from Ruth and Jay, and so we'll take a break and come for another session when we can do the rest of the book. We've got to page 48, you'll be glad to know, although we've only done two chapters. Not everybody writes their chapters the same length, and certainly it's very true of the chapters in the Quran.